The CDGA really is an exemplary golf association, and it's been around, you know, almost as long as the USGA, and golf in Chicago, I mean, in so many ways, it has had a profound effect in golf in the United States. I mean, really, the father of golf in the United States, Charles Blaine McDonald, you know, you think about what he did here in Chicagoland and with Chicago Golf Club, and I was just talking about, you know, one of the events that took place here in Chicago that people forget about, but talking about having a profound effect was the 1900 U.S. Open at Chicago Golf Club. And that was the first time any golf event in the United States truly had the world's best players. That's, you know, when the great Harry Vardon came over and some of the others, and that really propelled golf in this country. But, you know, you think about just the great traditions of golf here in Chicago, that, you know, whether I was just talking about caddying, that it's something in so many places in the country, we're losing caddies. But in Chicago, you haven't lost them. And it's a way to get youth involved in golf and really, you know, continue to keep the game healthy and grow it. But, you know, the Chicago District and the USGA have had a long relationship. The way we look at it is we couldn't even begin to do what we do without associations like the CDGA. I mean, whether it's conducting qualifying for our national championships or teaching rules of golf or handling amateur status issues or, you know, all the other things that kind of come up under governance and just running the game. We look at it saying it's in our best interest, and it's in the, more important, it's in the game's best interest to have a really good working relationship. And there's just been a solid volunteer support community here in Chicago for a long time. You've had a great staff with the CDGA for decades now. So it's a great relationship and one we cherish.
I think it's so many little things that they've done over the years that became influential on the national stage. Computerized handicapping.
Exactly.
First here. Just handicapping alone and how to do it. The best 10 out of 20 started in Chicago, and there was argument there, and then
it took a while for you guys to adjust to it.
It's exactly right. I mean, you know, that's just one example where you've been on the cutting edge here. And you think about that. I mean, it's one thing to run national championships or championships here, you know, in this region for your best players. But here you've done something with handicapping that's touching, at least in every golfer with a handicap. And, you know, the handicap system, you know, let us not forget, it's really what makes golf unique in sports. I mean, first of all, golf is a game of a lifetime. You can play it from when you're very young until you're very old. But, you know, in addition, it's the one sport that allows players of varying abilities to play on an equitable basis. The work that Chicago District has done in the area of handicapping and course rating has truly had, you know, not only national implications, but truly international.
When you listen to some of the golf fans here in town, they point out things like the PGA Tour keeps leaving every other year. The PGA of America hasn't given us any events since 2001. I know you only speak for the USGA, but it's been about 3 or 4 years since we got the amateur, and everyone's looking forward to Olympia Fields. But can you assess, from the USGA point of view, the Chicago market, and people are kind of wondering why we don't get the tournaments, or at least some of the ones that we used to get.
Given the long history of great championship golf in Chicagoland, it is a great question. I think from our point of view, you've got, when we're taking our national championships, whether it's the U.S. Open or the U.S. Girls Junior Amateur, we're going to, thankfully, some of the great courses in the United States that, by the way, has so many great golf courses. And so when we come here, I mean, you look back at how many national championships we've had, and we're very proud of that. But, you know, we're with the championship, USGA Championship Committee, you know, looks at it, first of all, golf course first. But then, you know, first of all, we do have to have an invitation first. So we're somewhat reactive in that. But once we get some interest, we'll go and look at it. And we start with the golf course first and say, okay, whether it's the U.S. Girls Junior Amateur or the U.S. Open, you say, for that given group of players, what kind of test is it? What's the architecture like? What are the agronomics like? What time of the year are we playing the championship? Then, if it's one of our opens, so it's, you know, U.S. Open, Women's Open, Senior Open, Then we're looking at logistics as well. So, you know, how much space do we have on site? What's the road system within the golf course? What's the road system out? Where do we put the tents? Where do we put grandstands? How many spectator bottlenecks are there? Where are the parking lots off-site? How will the corporate community support it? Where are the hotels? Where's the airport? Those kinds of things. And at the end, you know, speaking on, you know, just with the U.S. Open, we have, it's an amazing amount of invitations for that. I mean, more than we can handle. But having said that, I'll also say that, you know, nationwide, there aren't nearly as many courses that people would think that actually are capable of hosting a U.S. Open. And I don't want to speak for the PGA of America, but a PGA championship or whatever. Because, you know, when you look at all those factors, you all of a sudden start to say, well, okay, is the golf course there? Okay, and if it is, are all those other things there? And then there's sometimes courses that may be good enough that would just say, you know what, we're not interested in hosting a big event. It's too much. So all those things play into it. But listen, we do want to move our national championships around to different parts of the country. The fact is, Chicago's the third biggest market in the United States. The fact is, I mean, it's a storied past here in Chicago. The fact is, there are multiple courses that even for U.S. Opens, we could hold a championship on. So those are all great things. And our championship committee ultimately does look at it and say, okay, you know, we don't want to be in, whatever, New York 2 years in a row or you know, spread it out. We don't want to be in the West Coast 2 years in a row. So we do want to move things around. But ultimately, they're looking, you know, sometimes at maybe 15, 16, 18 courses that could host a U.S. Open and say, where do we want to go? And so it's, and then, you know, there's a balance between private clubs and public golf courses with municipal golf courses, resorts. There's going to old golf courses like a Marion, like an Oakmont, and then there's going to the new ones like an Erin Hills or a Chambers Bay. And so you really do want to balance with all those. And
Mike, I think after what you pulled off at Marion, you know, we've heard the term used for sports coaches, the miracle workers. People say now you can have any tournament anywhere. Mike showed us you could do it with Marion.
I'm not sure our operations people would. Well, I tell you, you know, with Marion, what's really interesting is there was never, at least not in my mind and some others at the USGA, there was never a doubt that the golf course was good enough. That was never a question. And even though some people wanted to think it was a question just because it was short on the scorecard, that wasn't the issue. The issue all along was, how the heck do you put a U.S. Open on a 110-acre piece of property? And the answer was some out-of-the-box thinking. I mean, literally, the homeowners that abutted some of the homes gave up their front yards for tents that were on there for months. We used the college that was next door, literally across a railroad track, to do things. And, you know, the player practice range was 2 miles away. I mean, there were things that you had to say, listen, Marion's a storied course, had this arguably where the greatest, you know, event ever took place in the United States, where Bob Jones, you know, won the final leg of his Grand Slam in 1930. So to get back there and to allow golfers to see that great history was wonderful. But listen, it was challenging, and the only way it ended up working was that everybody had to want that. And listen, that wasn't just the golf, you know, that wasn't just Marion and the USGA. And it wasn't just homeowners. It wasn't just the college. This had to be a community event, because there were a lot of big asks. And it's, you know, each, things like a U.S. Open, they're getting more and more challenging every year that goes on. I mean, just the amount of broadcast space you need for the international broadcasters has grown significantly. I mean, I actually, it's interesting, I cut my teeth, so to speak, here in Chicago back in 1990. So I lived, my first U.S. Open was that Medina U.S. Open that Hal Irwin won. And when I look back to that, so that was 25 U.S. Opens ago, the difference in how we're doing things now is just, it's night and day. And I'm not just talking about the golf course in terms of the length we need. I'm really talking about the space that's needed and the other parts of this thing, which just is, you know, I could never have visualized 25 years ago that it's turned into what it's turned into.
Well, I'm the ABC compound for that, and it was over by, what, the 16th hole. It was maybe four trucks, and now you need another 10 acres.
a few years ago, we had the U.S. Amateur at Oakland Hills in Detroit, and I can remember we had the 91 Senior Open was there, but the 96 U.S. Open was there, and same thing, is that, you know, the TV compound was left of the 15th hole, and I just scratched my head thinking, I can't even believe it. That wouldn't even suffice for even close to half of it now. So it's things change, and hopefully for the better.
Well, with Olympia Fields, from an operational standpoint, I guess it's nice to have both courses at one club.
Oh, it's wonderful. And, you know, since Steve Smyers did the renovation on the South Course, really good golf course. And, you know, obviously the North Course has been a storied great golf course for many years. But we're excited. And if you think about it, if you put yourself in the shoes of the amateurs that are coming to play. I mean, here's this storied golf course in the south side of Chicago that's hosted U.S. Opens, and it's a great thing. And to have two courses together, it just makes it so much easier. It makes it easier for the host venue, for us, but it also makes just a better experience for the players, too. And to have a 1-2 punch with those two wonderful courses is really exciting.
Speaking of 1-2 punches, Pinehurst this year was such a big hit. How soon would you like to do that again?
Well, interesting. We, believe it or not, haven't talked about it. You know, it doesn't mean we're closed-minded to it. I think everybody wanted to see how it would turn out and kind of take a step back. And first of all, there aren't many places that probably could do that. And think about it. If it's a private club, you know, it's a big ask already to give your facility up for, you know, really more than a week, but now all of a sudden you're doubling it. The other thing is, you know, it wasn't as if there weren't some challenges agronomically, that you really have to think about things almost doubling, because you have to say, you know, there's a bit of a crescendo. I mean, there's it's almost a bell curve on how you prepare agronomically for one of these championships, where you get the course healthy and you come into it kind of slow, and then by the time you get to championship rounds, you've got your speed where you want it, you hopefully have your firmness where you want it, and then by the, you know, when the event's over, okay, you know, give the course lots of water, and assuming it hasn't rained, and start to back off on your mow heights. And when you have a back-to-back championships, you've got to be thinking for the full 2 weeks. So, but, you know, it was great, and it ultimately did exactly what we wanted it to do, where it showcased women's golf. I mean, we literally tripled our ratings. And the other thing, I tell you, it was a learning experience, too, because for me, I used to set up the Women's Open, the golf course, for years. Still do set up the U.S. Open. And, you know, for years, I was under this impression that, yeah, you got to have the women playing a golf course roughly 600 to 700 yards shorter. We collected about 75,000 data points from both those weeks. We were literally tracking shots that the men and the women were hitting in practice rounds. In other words, what did you hit off the first tee? What did you hit into the green? What was your distance into the green? What happened when the ball landed, and how did it react as we were measuring moisture levels in the greens and firmness levels in the greens, green speeds. And anyway, long story short, what we were trying to do was set the golf course up the same for the men and the women. Same green speeds, basically same hole locations. We wanted roughly same clubs played off the tees, same clubs played into the greens. And there were a couple places where the architecture wouldn't allow that, and then we'd balance it out with another hole. But, you know, when it was all said and done, we needed to play the golf course for the women about 1,100 yards shorter to have the course play the same. And I think coming out, and they played it beautifully. I mean, that was a thing that when you look back, how well the men played it, but also the women played it. And I think, you know, for me personally, that was a learning experience to say. And then I started thinking about it weeks later and saying, you know, now it's starting to make sense, because I always used to watch the women hit more hybrids in. I mean, you think about it. How many times are you watching PGA Tour players hitting 3-irons or hybrids? You just don't see it. And maybe into a par 5. So I think we learned something. You know, it's something we'll carry through, not just at the Women's Open, the other thing. And I think it's helped. And we've certainly communicated that with the LPGA. And it was a great experience, but it was, you know, one I'm not sure we'd want to do every year back to back.
Like, we asked Tom about this, and he gave us some feedback on it. But the LPGA Legends Tour is growing. I know the question's been asked. A U.S. Senior Women's Open. Tom gave us his thoughts and the direction
sure.
the organization might go. But you're seeing a lot of your former champions out on that.
Absolutely. Channel. Well, you know, it's something. We started the U.S. Senior Open in 1980. And I will tell you, the USGA has been talking about this concept with the women really since back then. And the reason, at least to date, we didn't do it is we weren't convinced that from a competition standpoint, we would get the kind of field we needed to get. But I'll tell you, that has really been changing. And when you look at women in golf, and it's not, I'm not just talking about the former touring pros, but I'm talking about now the teaching pros that are women, that are, whether it's part of the LPGA teaching division or the PGA of America's females that are, and when you look at the number of amateurs that are playing senior women's golf, all those numbers are growing. And so we are looking at it seriously because, you know, philosophically you'd say there's no reason in the world the USGA should not be conducting it. We should. But you have to make sure it's a viable championship. We don't want to start something and then all of a sudden it just, it doesn't work and we have to decommission it. No one's wanted to do it, and that's been the fear. But, you know, I hope we're getting past that because I happen to be in very, very much in favor of this, at least philosophically. And, you know, I think it's the right thing to do because, as we know, these championships, listen, it's not just a competition for a given group of players. Championships inspire golf. And we actually do believe that if you'd have that would inspire, you know, the younger touring, female touring pros, but it would also inspire some of the amateurs saying, hey, this is my chance to play in it. Just like the senior amateurs, the men do, saying, this is my one big event a year. I want to try to qualify for the Senior Open. So it's an interesting thing that the championship committee is looking at. And, you know, again, if we do it, we're going to go in 100% with it. But we've just got to make sure that it can work and work long term. That's the thing we've been doing our homework on. Yeah, we almost had Bill Campbell do it in 1980, very first Senior Open that DeVincenzo won. Bill Campbell almost won it, but finished second there. But that's right, Catherine Lacoste was last one. In fact, I just saw her. She came back to the Women's Open reunion this year in Pinehurst, and it was fun to see her again.
I'll tell you what, having just played Rolling Green in Philadelphia, the gals are going to have a lot of fun at that U.S. Amateur in a couple of
They sure will.
Yeah, some of the members told me, they said, yeah, the USGA didn't want to come back after we beat up the gals here at the Open when Joanne Carner won about 30 years ago.
That's right.
But, Mike, can you tell us a little bit about the TV deal and how excited the USGA is about your agreement with Fox?
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess let me preface it by saying that in some ways we're saddened to be leaving two great domestic partners in NBC and ESPN, because in the case of NBC, you know, we've been with them or were with them the whole way back to 1995, and they just did a fabulous job. And beyond that, they were just wonderful people to work with. And then, same thing with ESPN. We actually have had, you know, a relationship with them since, well, for 32 years. So it's the same thing that you're taking two partners, and that's really what they've been, as partners. It wasn't just a business thing, it was a partnership. But we're equally excited with Fox. And for so many things, this is going to be good for the game of golf. I can remember one of the first people I called about this after we did the deal was Tim Finchem, commissioner of the PGA Tour. And Tim was absolutely delighted because he views it as you've now got all the major networks covering the game. And that was the one where, you know, Fox didn't have a presence. And, you know, you think about the great job they've done when they came into, you know, to baseball and to the NFL and, you know, racing and the other things they've done. So they're making a real commitment. And for us, it's not just a commitment to our Open championships, but a real commitment to the amateur championships. So I think it's exciting. And, you know, the other thing, I'd be remiss if I didn't say it, that our broadcast rights fees, the monies we're getting paid, have gone up significantly for that. And while there's some people that may be a little cynical about that, which is a head-scratcher, this is good for the game of golf because at the end of the day, we are a nonprofit. Our monies go back into the game. So these are more monies to put back, whether it's turf grass research, junior programs, governance things, you name it. So, I mean, golf in general should be very happy about this. So we're very excited about it, and June's going to be here before we know it, and we'll be off with the Fox team.
The theme tonight is 100 years as we go forward here. I don't know if you can look that far into the future. Tom's crystal ball didn't get to 100. Where do you see golf in general, golf in Chicago?
You know, in the last 8 years, there's been a lot of chatter that the game's broken. And I'm here to say, on behalf of the USGA, the game is anything but broken. Fundamentally, it is as sound as it's ever been. Yes, there are things about the game. We've got to, you know, whether it's the cost of the game, the time it takes, you know, participation levels. And there's reasons all those have been affected. But I think the USGA is very bullish on the game in the next 100 years. But, you know, what we focused on the last 100 years won't necessarily be the same things we'll focus on in the future. You know, what's going on with water, that will be, mark my word, that will be golf's biggest barrier in some parts of this country. And it's not just a cost issue, which that in and of itself, I mean, there's examples of courses that 10 years ago didn't pay any money for water. Now, they paid some, you know, obviously the electricity to irrigate it and so on with the system, but they went from no cost for water to now $1 million a year, and it's just going up exponentially. The other thing is, it's just in some places, even if you have the money, you're not going to be able to get it. We're seeing that right now in Southern California, where you can have all the money you want, and you've been cut down in half of what you used to get. So golf's going to have to, you know, it's going to have to change, and it's already starting to change. But all in all, I think, listen, golf is a game for the lifetime. It's healthy. The organization of golf in this country, the way it's organized, is very good. We'll work through this participation issue. We're going to work through the issue with, you know, there's been an oversupply the last, you know, couple decades of golf courses, and that's going to sort itself. That's already correcting itself, which is a good thing long term. So I think the next 100 years will be outstanding, and it's, you know, I'm not going to be here 100 years from now, but I'm excited for the game and for the next generations.
Well, looking into the future short term, I've heard you've been there. Do you have an initial impression of Mike Kaiser's Sand Valley in Wisconsin?
Well, I have been there twice. In fact, I'm going with him tomorrow again for a quick trip up. But, you know, first of all, you cannot believe that this is in middle America. There's just this, first of all, any golf course, if it's built on sand, all things being equal, is going to be better than a golf course not built on sand. It's just the drainage is better. You get a bouncier condition. It's healthier agronomically. But this property up in the middle of Wisconsin is spectacular. It's not only sandy, but it's just got terrific movement to it. I mean, it reminds you in some ways, if you've been around and played some of the Heathland golf courses around London, the Sunningdales, the Walton Heaths, the Wentworths, a little bit of some of that property, but then it also reminds you a little, I mean, it's got a little bit of Pine Valley in it and the Sandbury, where there's a lot of movement to the land. It's all sand. So it's spectacular. And, you know, Mike Kaiser is going to go down as one of the great visionaries in the game of golf. He will absolutely do it. I mean, he's in some ways a living legend right now with what he's done. There's no reason to think he's not going to do that again up at Sand Valley.
Mike, finally for me, could you just talk a little bit about your complex at Far Hills? I was just there. You know, maybe a lot of people, they might go to the Golf Hall of Fame in Florida in the winter, but you've got a great museum. You're adding the Nicholas Building, and it's a fantastic facility that more people who love the game should see.
We started in New York City in 1894 and were there the whole way through 1972, and then literally ran out of space. Plus, we wanted to do more testing of golf equipment. So we moved out to Far Hills, which is about 45 minutes due west of New York City. And it's in a beautiful kind of horse country. But as we joke internally, you kind of have to be lost to find it. So, but it has this just wonderful golf museum there. It's really, it's this country's oldest, really, golf museum, or excuse me, sports museum, older than Major League Baseball and older than basketball. And it is the world's biggest golf museum, biggest library. It is definitely worth a visit when you're there. And in addition, when you're there, you can take a tour through our research and test center where we do all the testing for conformance on balls and clubs. And it's a campus that has about 78 acres, so it's very pretty. And, you know, it's a great place. I mean, I feel certainly very fortunate, like the other staff, that going there on a daily basis to work. It's a great experience.